From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. Sarah McCammon vividly remembers a moment when she was just 4 years old that she sat in a church in Kansas City watching in horror as an actor portrayed Jesus Christ during the crucifixion. Christ's death on an executioner's cross by the Roman leaders of Judea is important to Christians who believe that God permitted his son, Jesus, to be executed in order to atone for the sins of humanity. This is why Christians often wear crosses around their necks and display them in their homes and their churches. Without this death, there would be no resurrection, which Christians believe to have been the sign that Christ was victorious over sin and death, and that they can be too. And so many Christians, especially evangelicals, reenact these scenes each year in pageants. In bigger churches, these morality plays are highly produced spectacles with spotlights and fake blood and the anguished screams of the actors playing the role of Jesus. But for the four-year-old girl sitting in that church, this was terrifying. She thought the actor on the cross was really dying, and even though her parents told her it was all pretend, she was confused and scared. This wasn't the last time that McCammon would feel uncertain about what to believe as she grew up in the evangelical church. And she wasn't alone. As a Christian theologian Paul Tillich once wrote, "Doubt isn't the opposite of faith, it is an element of faith." But increasingly, these doubts are getting the better of people of faith who are increasingly leaving their religious upbringings as a result. This is happening, by the way, in pretty much every faith, but it seems to be a particularly pronounced phenomenon in recent years in the evangelical movement. And that's the focus of McCammon's recent book, The Ex-Evangelicals. Sarah McCammon is a national political correspondent for NPR and co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. Her work focuses on political, social, and cultural divides in America, including the intersections of politics and religion. Sarah McCammon, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to fast forward from the experience that that scared little four-year-old girl was having during the crucifixion scene to an experience that you had that was a little less scary, perhaps, maybe even a little bit funny, because your dad seems like he was a pretty funny guy. But it was also sort of unsettling to you. This happened during a trip to Washington, D.C. when you were in middle school. Tell me about your first visit to the Smithsonian.
Well, starting in fifth grade, I found one of my passions for my middle school years, which was spelling bees, because I was that cool. And I worked really hard, and every year I got a little bit better. Finally, in eighth grade, the last year I could do it, I made it to the National Christian School Spelling Bee, and we made a family trip, and it was really exciting. And yeah, one of the things we did was go to the Smithsonian Museums. And I noticed there references to million-year-old fossils. And, you know, this for me was, it was always a little bit confusing and unsettling, because everyone around me, in my Christian school, in my church, certainly in my home, told me that the earth was 6 to 10,000 years old, that the Bible told the literal story of the creation of the world in the book of Genesis. It happened in 7 days, not millions and billions of years, as I was seeing on these signs. And, you know, it was just one of those many moments, which I talk about in the book, where things just kind of felt off about the world that I was seeing around me in comparison to the world I was being told about in my evangelical community.
And you're with your dad, and he's kind of doing an impression of Carl Sagan saying the words millions and billions of years throughout this little trip, right?
When the topic of evolution would come up, yeah, he would say like millions and billions, because I think he thought it was kind of funny. There was a lot of time invested in communicating to us the idea that scientists were wrong, that they were lying, that they were misled by the devil, and that we needed to accept the biblical account of creation.
But you write in this book that you start wondering at this point, like, wait a second, hold on. Everybody else is wrong, but we're right?
Yeah, you know, and like I said, there would be these little moments where things would sort of poke in to the bubble that I was really surrounded by. And I think, yes, religion is on the decline across the board in this country. You know, most religions, particularly Christianity, are not growing. But there is something really specific about the evangelical subculture. I mean, it's a huge subculture, first of all. You know, something like 1 in 4, 1 in 5 people at one time have, you know, fell into, under that category of evangelical or white evangelical. And certainly when I was young, the movement was at its peak. So it's a huge number of people, and yet it's so insular. And there is this entire sort of parallel universe, as people have called it, of books and movies and media and educational systems designed to sort of protect children and young people as they grow up, train them in what their parents and teachers and pastors believe is the truth. And it's very hard to kind of penetrate that if everything and everyone around you believes all the same things. And yet, it's hard not to notice when you go to a museum. It's hard not to notice that not everybody thought like that. And so that created a lot of questions in my mind.
And those interactions play a big role in another big moment in your life. This is when you're not quite 17 years old, and you go and you spend a semester in Washington, D.C. This is in 1998. It's right in the midst of the scandal involving President Clinton's sex acts with a White House intern, which I'm thinking would have maybe seemed to confirm a young conservative's worldview about the deeply flawed and sinful nature of the other political side. But you're also like living and working with Catholics and Latter-day Saints, including a really cute little Mormon boy that you write about, and then Muslims. And in that later category of faith, there's this Iranian-American boy named Sina. Tell me about Sina.
You know, I checked in with him recently because I was writing this book and I wanted to make sure he was okay with me talking about him. He was just the sweetest kid, like just popular and so kind and just genuinely through and through. Everybody liked Sina, and he was just a genuinely good, kind guy. And, you know, we got to know each other over the course of the semester. And, you know, I learned his backstory about his parents immigrating from Iran and some of the challenges that they had gone through, and talked about our backgrounds and our upbringing. And he knew about mine. And as I remember it, we're sitting on the Senate rostrum. So we would sit on those little steps and wait for senators to summon us to do things like get them water, or get them an easel, or whatever it is that they needed. That was our job as pages. And, you know, there's a lot of time to kill sometimes. So we're sitting there chatting. And one day he asked me, in the course of a larger conversation about, I think, our beliefs, he asked me if I thought that he was going to hell because he was a Muslim. And no one had ever asked me that directly. No one had ever sort of put such a fine point on it, even though everyone around me in my church and school and family, we were always talking about how to win over the lost, you know, praying for people if we knew them that were quote unquote unsaved.
Because you had been told this kid, not specifically, but, you know, Muslims are not going to go to heaven, and Jews are not going to go to heaven, and Mormons are not going to go to heaven. They are lost in some way and they need to be saved.
Right. I mean, anybody that didn't align with our theology, even some Catholics, we thought weren't going to heaven. I mean, it wasn't enough to just be Christian. You had to be the right kind of Christian. And the way evangelicals would say it is they would say you had to have a genuine relationship with Jesus and you had to have a genuine belief in Jesus. But there was really no room for a divergence of opinion or culture in that. And so when Sina asked me this, it just kind of stopped me dead, because I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, you know, it almost feels like a math problem. Like, well, 1 + 1 = 2. You know, you're not a Christian, you're going to hell. Like, it was that simple. But I couldn't say this to my friend. Like, it didn't feel right to me. And, you know, and then a major character in this book is my grandfather, who was sort of the dominant foil throughout my childhood for everything that I was being taught, because he was not a Christian. And he was the focus of most of our prayers. We prayed just about every night at dinner for his salvation.
And you even wrote a paper in college about how this poor, brilliant man, a brain, like literally a brain surgeon, right? Like, this poor, brilliant man, despite his brilliance, is going to go to hell. How sad.
He's sort of a through line for the whole book. And I think heightening all of this was not only the fact that he was not a Christian and was not interested in becoming one, but that he was coming to terms late in life with his own sexuality. At the time that I was, you know, about 3 years after I was born, my grandmother passed away, and my grandfather, who had been born in the 1920s, had, you know, as he told me, gone to Harvard just a decade or two after Harvard purged all of its gay faculty, and I believe students as well. You know, he'd grown up in a world where he couldn't be who he was, which is ironically kind of like the one a lot of evangelicals grow up in today. And so he was as suddenly, you know, a widower at about 60, coming to terms with his sexuality. And that was coming into conflict in a dramatic way with my parents' beliefs at a time when my parents were, you know, this was the height of the moral majority, the Reagan movement. And so my grandfather's existence and his life was totally at odds with my parents' beliefs and the things that they saw as their values. And I, as this little girl, found myself kind of sitting right in the middle of all of that and trying to figure out how to process that.
All of these experiences that you describe, they contribute to what you've written in your book as a sort of unraveling. And you said that you don't know what the crux of your personal unraveling was, but I am wondering if there came a point in time in which you recognized not simply that you had unraveled, but that you wouldn't be, for lack of a better term, I'll coin one here, re-raveled.
It happened so gradually, and it was something I was afraid of. I think I always sensed it was possible. There are many things about Christianity and the evangelical community that I found quite wonderful and beautiful. But I think I always sensed that this sort of exclusionary part of it was not for me. For myself, at least, there were so many years of struggle and of trying to make this whole sort of vision of the world that I'd been given and that meant something to me, but that also had these ideas within it that I just couldn't sort of tolerate. I couldn't make sense for me. Having to try to negotiate all of that and hold myself together while feeling such powerful cognitive dissonance, you know, it was really challenging. And I think a lot of people I talked to felt some version of that. Like, you know, you're taught to seek truth, you're taught to seek authenticity, you're taught to sort of examine yourself and look for things that are wrong. And for a lot of people, you do that enough. And I mean, at least for me, I came to the conclusion that I wasn't comfortable with a belief system that forced me to exclude people like Sina or my grandfather.
Part of the struggle that comes from realizations like this and struggles like this is the ultimate impact it has on relationships with people who remain fully immersed in the faith. How common is it that an ex-evangelical, someone who is moving away from the faith, has an experience in which they don't have to go through these painful exchanges, where sort of the family members do it right? At least I'm being a little subjective here in what I think is right, but did you find anyone who had left this movement who didn't feel scarred by the exchanges that they had with their loved ones in the process?
What I will say is, I think based on my reporting and just friendships and conversations with people, you know, my sense is that there are different ways that people navigate this. And there's a spectrum of, you know, some people do become completely or almost completely estranged from their families. And, you know, others, I think, sort of agree not to talk about certain things and everything in between. But, you know, I think there's a certain amount of sort of squinting and not looking at things if they're too disruptive to the relationship. You know, for a long time, I covered stuff that had nothing to do with politics. And, you know, I really only found myself in 2016 when I was assigned to cover the Republican primary, suddenly confronted with all of these questions about evangelical politics and who evangelicals were, and it became unavoidable. And so I just kind of decided to turn it into, I guess, what one of my friends and colleagues called it, my superpower, which is, I know this world really well. So I'm going to try to bring that insight, you know, as professionally as possible to my work. And that's, you know, in many ways, I've really just decided to write this book because I was seeing that in the wake of that really kind of cataclysmic moment, more and more people who had complicated relationships with evangelicalism were talking about it and talking about it publicly. I just felt like there was something to say.
Let's talk about the 2016 election cycle. Donald Trump plays a pretty important role in this book. This is a person who seems in many ways to be like the last person most people would have expected to become the standard bearer for evangelicals, this twice divorced person, known adulterer, you know, had never really bothered to pretend to be religious before making a play for the presidency. But what is just absolutely fascinating to me is that not only have white evangelicals lined up behind Trump, but over the course of his presidency, white Americans have actually become more likely to identify themselves as evangelical. Even if they don't regularly pray or read the Bible or attend church, they've aligned these two identities quite significantly.
The takeaway that scholars I've interviewed have come away with, and that I think is really true, is that, you know, evangelicalism used to be primarily a theological term, and it has become, you know, it's always had sort of a political project attached to it. But that political project has become front and center in a way that means that increasingly, if you call yourself an evangelical, it means something politically. And if you don't share those politics, you're less likely to use the evangelical label, even if you, you know, may have some beliefs in common.
White evangelicals make up a big portion of the crowds at Trump rallies, these rallies you've been covering as a journalist for quite a few years now. And well, maybe can you describe what it's like to be a journalist at a Trump rally?
I am a white woman from the Midwest, so it's kind of easy for me to move in those crowds. I don't stand out. But what I would notice is that once I got inside the room and Trump took the stage and he began his speech, which almost always included attacks on the press, which seemed to get more and more intense and vitriolic as the campaign continued, and to the point where at the end it was something he would bring up not just once, but, you know, circle back to again and again. He would say, you know, look at those people back there. Look at those disgusting reporters. They're the worst people. And I think, you know, it had the effect, and I think it was quite successful in the minds of some of his followers, of delegitimizing the press, who were, at least according to the tenets of, I think, constitutional democracy, the job of the press, at least in theory, one of our jobs, right, is to watchdog people in power and to apply scrutiny and pay attention and provide context and call them out or fact check them when they say things that are untrue. And by persuading people that the press was illegitimate, or at least the mainstream press, you know, he really was able to sort of remove one of those critical checks on his message and his power.
This is, you write, pretty painful, emotional, stressful, exhausting. But at one point, this had you reflecting on what is, for I think any Christian, one of the hardest to follow passages of the New Testament, Matthew 5, which describes Jesus's Sermon on the Mount. This is really where Jesus lays out his very lofty expectations for anyone who's going to follow him. This is the chapter where we get to the notion that Christians are supposed to love their enemies. And these Christians are certainly not, you know, heaping love upon you and your fellow journalists. But what strikes me about this is that as you reflected on this, it wasn't because you were chastising these people who call themselves Christian but weren't acting like it. You were thinking about how you would get through it yourself. And this all goes back to that crucifixion pageant that you watched as a little girl when Christ is in the middle of being executed and he prays, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do."
It was a weird moment for me because I did not, by this point, feel very religious. I was not going to church all that regularly. But, you know, it was one of those loud, rowdy crowds just before the 2016 election. And I was tired. You know, I'd been on buses and planes for days, sleeping only a few hours a night, under a lot of stress, on deadline. All pretty typical stuff for the end of a campaign. But, you know, the net effect of it is that you're frazzled and you don't feel good. It wasn't fun to be in that environment again, being yelled at. I'm just trying to do my job. You just want people to leave you alone and just let you do your job. You know, the thing that really surprised me, and I think this is probably sort of the nature of faith, one of the cool things about it for people who have spiritual or religious experiences is that sometimes it's not something that you like choose, or something that, you know, for all the emphasis in my childhood on like making a choice, making a decision, getting your head right, getting your heart right, like I just had this very spontaneous, unexpected, unasked for moment where I felt like this incredible peace and strength just thinking about, like, I was angry at these people, not necessarily because of their political beliefs or anything like that, but I just was tired of the way they were treating us and I had enough. And it was like there was this reservoir I didn't know was there that I just started thinking about, like, yeah, like Jesus wants us to love our enemies. And I guess in this moment, these people are my enemies. And I felt like this compassion and this peace and strength. And I was at the end of my rope. And suddenly I just felt like something from somewhere else buoyed me. And I'm not the kind of person that has a lot of religious experiences like that. And I'm not passing judgment on what it was. Maybe it was just some product of my exhausted brain, you know, churning out some little secret supply of adrenaline. But it felt very spiritual to me. And I felt grateful for it because it felt like this, again, it wasn't something I could have chosen. And it really got me through, like just gave me the strength to keep doing my job at a time when I felt completely burned out, you know, and that doesn't happen all the time. There are other times I have definitely been at the end of long deadline ridden days and I've just melted down and cried or, you know, maybe not been the nicest person to my family members. But in that moment, it felt like if there was ever a moment that like God gave me strength, that was it. And I was really grateful for it more than anything. Because I think a lot of times I'd hear sermons about that, like turn the other cheek, love your enemies, do good to those who hurt you. And it would feel like there's a part of me that kind of resented that. It was like, don't be a pushover, you know, don't take it when people punch you. You should punch back. But for me in that moment, it wasn't about like, again, it wasn't about deciding to be kind. It was about just having like what felt like a strength that wasn't my own to do the right thing or just to continue.
That's Sarah McCammon. She's a national politics correspondent for NPR and the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. And she's also the author of a new book called The Ex-Evangelicals. Sarah McCammon, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30 a.m. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.